My name is Leonard Leo, and I serve as Executive Vice President of the Federalist Society, and it's my privilege to welcome you all here today to our 2008 Lawyers Convention. And isn't it good to be here today amongst so many friends, amongst friends from all over the country, and indeed from even across the Atlantic, amongst friends who hail from communities with hundreds of other judges, lawyers, law students, academics, and business leaders who can't be with us today, but who have graciously supported and been a part of our work in more than a quarter century. We as an institution have much to be thankful for and many important opportunities to look forward to that we can leverage for building a greater appreciation for limited constitutional government in this country. Our president and CEO, Gene Meyer, offered an important observation the other day that was featured in the Legal Times. He said, and I quote, "The assumption in Washington is that the closer you are to power, the more influence you have. That's not necessarily true. At the end of the day, power is the second to last word in the affairs of Washington. Ideas are the last word." It's that understanding that has contributed greatly to the Federalist Society's success. And as I sat down to prepare my introduction of this morning's opening speaker, Gene's observation also came to mind, because Senator Mitch McConnell is one of those rare national leaders who understands the power of ideas and a commitment to the first principles that lay the foundation for those ideas. To be sure, Senator McConnell is a public official with enormous experience and tactical ability. He has waged and managed many an important battle in the halls of the United States Senate. But even more importantly, his career has been marked by a deep commitment to and frequent articulation of the ideas that are the bedrock of the constitutional system that our framers built. On more occasions than I can count, Senator McConnell has harkened back to those first principles: the separation of powers, federalism, freedom of speech and freedom of religion, limits on national power, and a judicial philosophy grounded on originalism and textualism. In the rough and tumble of the legislative process, those ideas may not always hold sway. But one can hope that Senator McConnell's leadership in bringing these ideas to the surface will inspire other public figures to take hold of those principles, and perhaps even inspire some in private life to involve themselves more fully in the business of politics and public policy. Please join me in welcoming Senator Mitch McConnell.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to town. I want to begin by thanking Eugene Meyer and Leonard Leo for their superb leadership of the Federalist Society. As usual, you have an outstanding program with lots of impressive speakers, and I appreciate the honor of being here to open your meeting. This organization has long been one of my favorites. I can remember as a young senator taking a keen interest in this group that stood for fidelity to the original meaning of the Constitution, open and vigorous debate, and the quaint idea that the framers separated the three branches of government for a reason. And I've tried to advance those same ideas throughout my Senate career. For example, the current law, which regulates citizen participation in federal elections, runs to about 500 pages. But I've always thought the founders said everything that needed to be said about the regulation of elections in 10 simple words. Congress shall make no law, abridging the freedom of speech. Over the past 2 years, I've brought the conservative principles we share to my duties as Republican leader of the Senate. And I was gratified this week when my colleagues voted me unanimously for another two-year term just the other day. I also share one other thing with the Federalist Society, and that is a love for the Secretary of Labor. Elaine is the longest-serving member of the President's Cabinet, and in my opinion, the best Labor Secretary we have ever had by far. She also is a big fan of this organization and sends her regards. And one of the things we've enjoyed is on a number of occasions, we've been able to go to the to Ted Olson's house. Lots of you all have done that with these young aspiring lawyers from the law schools around the country in the summer, and it's really uplifting to get a report on the status of conservative thinking among students across America. And of course, I always ask them what their faculties are like, and that's usually depressing. I also share with the Federalist Society a tendency to invite exaggerated claims by my critics. A few years ago, a critic of the Federalist Society referred to this organization as, quote, a conservative cabal that's attacking America from within. And for the past year, any Kentuckian with a radio or a television set heard that the guy you're looking at is not only single-handedly responsible for America's economic troubles, but was also the greatest single enemy of progress since, well, maybe Nino Scalia. And they reelected me anyway. It just goes to show how far a dazzling charisma can get you. So thank you for having me this morning. I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm delighted to have at least another 6 years to promote conservative ideas and Republican solutions in the United States Senate. It was a challenging reelection. The other side had their long swords out for me, but I'm refreshed and re-energized by the battle. Churchill was right when he said the most exhilarating thing is to be shot at and missed. Now, mine wasn't the only election that took place on November 4th. We've just come through the longest and perhaps most intriguing presidential race in our nation's history. Barack Obama was not my candidate, but he was an impressive campaigner and has the potential to be an impressive president. As president, his likeliest path to success is the same path he chose as a candidate. Throughout the campaign, President-elect Obama downplayed partisanship. He expressed a willingness to use force to defend our nation's interests, and he promised a tax cut to 95% of Americans. He seemed serious, competent, and most importantly, he convinced the voters that his policies would help them directly in a moment of extraordinary economic uncertainty. In short, once the primaries were through, the president-elect campaigned down the middle. And if he chooses to govern the way he campaigned in the general election, he will find the U.S. Senate as a place where big things can be achieved for the American people. Governing in the middle is frequently not the first inclination of new presidents. The first inclination of most new presidents is to push every one of their most partisan ideas through Congress. And two things usually happen as a result. They get little or nothing done in return, and they burn whatever political capital they had right up. But the 60-vote threshold can be put to extremely good use for the majority, especially on major legislative initiatives. Since few parties ever have 60 votes, majorities almost always have to reach across the aisle in the Senate to get the votes they need for a bill to actually pass and have a chance of becoming law. This forces issues into the middle, and it also provides an opportunity for the two parties to take on politically sensitive issues they wouldn't be willing to take on alone. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Reagan and Tip O'Neill and the Social Security fix in 1983. Clinton and the Republican Congress on welfare reform in 1996. And even though you're thinking, well, those were situations where you had divided government, that is, one party in the White House and another party with one or both houses, that doesn't apply to this situation. Well, it does. it does apply. Because the really big issues, like the unfunded liabilities we have as a result of the incredible disparities that are built into the Social Security and Medicare systems as a result of the aging of the baby boomers, even though you could potentially tackle that with unified government on a one-party basis, it's very dangerous to your political health. And if you're going to do something on a big issue like Medicare or Social Security, you better have bipartisan buy-in or the political blowback is so intense, you run the risk of no longer having a majority in one or both of your houses. So you get the drift. My challenge to him is to do big things while he has the maximum amount of political capital and to do them on a bipartisan basis. We could start with some of the things he promised on the campaign trail. Senator Obama promised to rein in entitlement spending. I just mentioned that. He promised to cut taxes. He promised to pay down the national debt. He promised energy independence. And he promised to ensure America's long-term financial stability. All of those are mega issues that no matter what his majority ends up being in the Senate, would be difficult to tackle successfully politically on an entirely partisan basis. President-elect Obama understands all of this, I believe. In fact, after heavy Democratic losses in 2004, a newly elected Senator Obama had some interesting advice for the Republican majority, and here's what he said. One of the things I think the president made a mistake with when he came in 2000 was to push a very aggressive agenda that wasn't the way he campaigned. And I would give the same advice if John Kerry wins that I would give to President Bush, and that is that we are deeply divided right now, but there are a core set of values we share as Americans that we can build on. We have to start off working on that common ground as opposed to immediately trying to focus on those issues that divide us most deeply. So the advice he gave in 2004 is good for him in 2008. Put the partisan laundry list aside, and while your political capital is at its highest, do important things for the American people and do them on a bipartisan basis in the middle. If he doesn't, he's likely to have problems. First, Republicans will not hesitate to take on highly partisan legislation. The unions, for example, want President-elect Obama to eliminate the right of American workers to a secret ballot in union elections. I assure you we will do absolutely everything we can to see to it that that never becomes law. And we'll do the same on other issues where fundamental freedoms, security, or prosperity are at stake. But again, I want to be clear, my strong preference is that we accomplish big things, that we focus on the issues that affect most Americans, and that we operate on a bipartisan basis. I believe the president-elect knows what that requires. So what about judicial nominations? Well, unfortunately, this is an area where Senate Democrats have distorted and abused the traditional confirmation process over the last 8 years. By now, the process barely resembles what it was when I first arrived in the Senate. Let's review what they've done. You may recall the infamous retreat Democrats held early in 2001 at which Professors Tribe and Sunstein suggested changing the ground rules for judicial confirmations. Their advice was taken, and soon afterwards, Senator Schumer scheduled hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee to justify the coming changes. The first hearing was entitled, Should Ideology Matter? It will come as no surprise that Senator Schumer answered that question in the affirmative. A little sound effect there on that. Just wanted to make sure you understood that point. Specifically, he said it would now be extremely important to have ideological moderates on the federal bench. And by moderate, he did not mean judges who moderately adhere to the rule of law. He meant judges who would be politically moderate with respect to the outcome of each case. According to his view, Democrats would be the sole arbiters of political moderation. The next hearing was entitled "The Senate's Role in the Nomination and Confirmation Process, Whose Burden?" Whose burden? It will come as no surprise that Democrats concluded it was the nominee's burden to prove that he or she should be confirmed and that the president should be entitled to little, if any, deference. Now, I don't recall Senate Democrats placing this burden on President Clinton's judicial nominees, but by 2001, the rules were changing. Democrats were now determined to impose a new burden on the nominees of President Bush, even though he was committed to employing traditional criteria in selecting those nominees. Instead of the traditional standard of legal ability, integrity, temperament, and above all, fealty to the law, Democrats were now insisting on other considerations, like sympathy for certain groups. And over the past 8 years, Democrats, including then-Senator Obama, have had ample opportunity to test their new standard. We saw it on clear display in their deliberations over the Roberts nomination. As one Democrat after another described the nominee as one of the finest the Senate had ever considered, and then voted against him on extra constitutional grounds. It was in this vein that Senator Kennedy famously asked on the Senate floor, whose side is Judge Roberts on in cases that come before him? Astonishing thing to say in public. Another Democratic senator described the position of Chief Justice as akin to that of an elected official or someone who favors certain political constituency over others. In the end, half the Democrats voted against Judge Roberts, and then-Senator Obama's argument was typical of the dissenting view. After noting that Judge Roberts clearly had the intellect and qualifications to sit on the Supreme Court, he nevertheless opposed the confirmation because, as he said, he gave more weight to Judge Roberts' political philosophy. For Democrats, it seems political ideology, that is, whose side are you on, is more important, and was now the paramount criteria for confirmation. And that's where we stand today, except that now it's a Democrat who will be doing the nominating, and a Democrat has explicitly stated on the campaign trail that the primary criteria he will use in choosing judicial nominees is their ability to empathize with certain groups. The question now, of course, is how Republicans should respond. In my opinion, we should reject the permanent establishment of an entirely subjective, extra-constitutional test for judicial nominees. We cannot countenance a process where nominees will be selected based upon whether they promise or presume to favor certain sides in litigation. This is antithetical to what judging is. I can recall the Chief Justice saying at his hearings he thought the role of a judge was similar to that of a referee at a sporting event. And this approach calls into question whether nominees who are chosen on these grounds will ever be capable of living up to their solemn oath of administering justice without respect to persons. Republicans have always insisted that the judicial oath means what it says, and we will continue to insist on it. If President Obama's top criterion in selecting nominees is empathy, then the burden will be on them to demonstrate that their political views do not trump their even-handed reading of the law. There is one side that judges should be on. Just one side that judges should be on. And that's the side of the law. This does not change in the Obama administration. The topic of this year's convention, the people in the courts, is particularly timely. America will soon have a new president with some very unorthodox views about the nomination and confirmation of federal judges. The Federalist Society has made an impressive contribution over the past 25 years to the promotion of the idea that judges should interpret, not create, the law. You have distinguished yourself for your promotion of open, robust debate on the issues vital to the future. I can think of no more urgent moment for the Federalist Society than now. President-elect Obama's ideas on the judiciary must be discussed and debated, and clear judgments must be reached. I wish you well in that effort. I appreciate so much the opportunity to be here this morning, and I hope you have a great convention. Thank you so much.